I'm not going to do it for a really long time. It's going to be like a 3-minute review.
All right.
It's fine. Just content filler.
Your whole show can't be content filler.
Another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Los Angeles, I am Cassidy Robinson, and with me today is friend of the show from San Diego, Keith Foster.
Hi, am I the jabber or the drone?
I don't know. We'll have to let the listeners decide on this episode. I've been working all day, so I'm probably going to be the drone.
Okay.
Although, do we want to call what you've been doing working?
Nah, it's okay.
You don't call it work?
I mean, hey, we don't need to get into it.
No, we surely do.
I've been hooking.
Well, some working actors might call the hustle work hooking of a sort.
I guess. All right. Well, now we have to talk about it.
Yeah, because it's the only thing I had to talk about at the top of the show. So you've been hanging out here in Los Angeles. You've been doing the trek every couple weekends or so because you're doing what?
I'm officially doing 101 at Upright Citizens Brigade for improv. It's really sort of weird because I've been doing improv for a decade next year.
That's weird to think about.
A decade.
I know.
And now I have to take a 101 course. But, you know, I actually had some like little mini breakthroughs today. So it's still, it's worth it.
The way you described it, it's like ayahuasca or something like that. What do you mean by breakthroughs?
There were just some theories that we had like used to sort of teach in the comedy project, and which was my old improv troupe in Idaho,
right?
Which we bought the UCB handbook when it came out, whatever, like 2 years ago, mm-hmm. And you know, we read it and we applied some of the theories, and there were just some things that were like. Like, we had applied, and we had applied them correctly, but not necessarily to, like, the fullest extent you can apply it. Is it?
We're really deep inside baseball and comedy right now.
Yeah. Anyway, so there were just a couple moments. Even though it's a 101 course, what I'm getting at is it's still useful. And it feels cool to be active doing improv again.
Right. And I would think of all of the things, yes, it's degrading to have to learn how to like the basics of yes and or Del Close or whatever, but at least you're doing improv on the UCB stage.
No, technically I'm doing improv in the UCB classroom.
Next to the room that has the UCB stage.
On Sunset, which is the new stage they built near yes. The UCB stage on Franklin. Which they built after the UCB stages in New York. So
right.
It's pretty far removed from like where Amy Poehler grew up. But I mean, you know, they have like pictures of them and that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it feels nice to be active again.
Right. And I mean, you've been doing stuff in San Diego. We've had you on the podcast before and you've talked about you do a little YouTube show and.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. And by YouTube show, I mean, it's not like you in front of your camera showing your vinyl records like I've done. Like, you've done, like, you have, like, an actual show with, like, a production budget yes. And a stage and an audience. And
yeah. And I just had an improv show this last Saturday, too. So, yeah, it's not like I've been not doing anything, but it's kind of nice to, like, do the thing that I sort of wanted to come here to do.
Right. Now that we got that out of the way, you had a bone to pick with me. Or a couple, maybe?
Specifically that you gave me Netflix homework for your podcast that you didn't watch.
Technically, Richard gave me Netflix homework that I didn't watch. And that was over a month ago. If you're following this podcast at all, I don't know. Do I really need to get into the whole thing of why we haven't done a podcast for a month? I took a vacation, so we didn't do it that week.
All right.
And then we were going to do it the week after, and I wasn't able to for some reason or another. He wasn't able to for some reason to another. Anyways, the weeks just kind of stacked up, and now we're finally making it happen. But
yeah.
Within that time, and the time I told you to watch the Netflix homework, I forgot to.
So you had, like, 2 months to watch this movie, and I had, like...
Like a month and a week.
I literally had, like, 2 days available to watch this, and I somehow managed to do it, and you didn't.
Right. That's exactly how it happened. We'll fill that time with something else.
But... I'm going to do my own podcast and tell all your listeners about High Rise starring Tom Hiddleston.
It'll be the High Rise podcast every week. It'll be... What was that one podcast where they reviewed Grown Ups 2 every week? They had to watch it every week and
that
for
sounds
a year.
Like a psychological nightmare. Torture.
It was called the worst idea ever or something like that.
That is. That's kind of popular with like TV seasons where I think that's
The Talking Dead. And
I think that's kind of lazy, like where podcasters just pick a show and then they watch the show and talk about the show.
Right.
Kumail did one with X-Files and I don't remember what it was called. I've never listened to it, in all fairness, so it could be amazing. But to me, just like on the conceit, I'm like, all right.
Well, like any podcast, it has less to do with the actual content is and more to do with how entertaining it is to hear the people talking about it, which I shouldn't have just said, because now everyone's going to judge this podcast based on that criteria. Yes, please be more entertaining. No, you had bone to pick with me about the whole, like, I don't really watch movie trailers thing.
Yeah, well, I was like, before we started recording, I was like, did you see the Rogue One trailer? We could talk about that.
No, I haven't.
Rogue One, A Star Wars Story.
Well, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I did see, like, the first teaser in the theater a long time ago. It shows, like, a ship landing and then somebody walking out of it.
No, that's not the same. Like, they released one trailer, which I was like, all right. My problem with Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, is that it's not Episode 8. And Episode 7, like, really got me back into Star Wars in a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
And I want that tale to continue. So it's like this weird interlude of a prequel, which looks great. Like it looks amazing. I just can't get as excited for it as
it's not the main event.
Yeah. It's like, I want to know what's going on with Rey and Kylo Ren and Luke and what's with that pensive look he gave her. Like I want that story to unfold, but I just sort of have to wait to get a prequel of a story that I kind of already know, but it looks like it's really good.
What if George Lucas in 1980, whatever, had really hyped a new Star Wars film and people were super pumped about it and like, oh my God, we didn't know there was going to be another one.
Uh-huh.
These the prequels he's been talking about forever.
Didn't this happen and it was really bad?
Well, no, in 1980, whatever.
Oh, okay.
And then like with very little, like really teasery kind of like mystery box style advertising, which I didn't really do back then. People go line up, they sleep on the streets and then they go to see the first Ewok movie.
That might have happened.
I'm not sure. Did the Ewok movie have a theatrical release?
No, I don't think it did. But I bet when it came out on Disney or whatever, I bet people were stoked. It was just like when he did the Christmas special, like people were really excited about that.
Right.
And I mean, the rest is history. I'm sure there's whole podcasts dedicated to the Star Wars Christmas special, so I'm not going to go down that
rabbit hole. And the Ewok movies. I have fond memories of the Ewok movies. One, because it was the first Star Trek anything, or Star Trek. It's the first Star Wars anything I've ever seen.
Bad form. I don't know. The girl with the, like, too curly blonde, like, it's too curly and blonde, her hair, like, always kind of bugged me.
because she had curly blonde hair. Actually, she looked a lot like the little boy who was in Flowers from the Attic.
She actually looked a lot like the little girl that I had a crush on in kindergarten and threw up in that blonde curly hair. So I have some like weird
sense memory, bad memory.
Yeah, so it's like when I see like curly lamb's hair that's so blonde, it's white, it just kind of makes me want to throw up.
Okay. Was that one of the breakthroughs that you had today in your class?
Yes. Yeah.
You did a whole, like, scene about that.
Improv therapy unlocked my hatred of curly locks.
All right. I think from there, today we're going to be officially reviewing The Girl on the Train. I'll be reviewing Magnificent Seven because I saw that a long time ago. And at the end of the program, instead of the Netflix homework, we're going to talk a little bit about the TV shows we're watching, because you do a lot more of that than I do.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go ahead and get into the movie news.
All right.
Picked a few stories. There was a lot to choose from. We'll start with this one, because it's been developing as we went. Duncan Jones, son of David Bowie, which you just found out about.
I just found that out before the mic was on. And that was another bone I had to pick with you, is we were having these great conversations before the recording was happening, mm-hmm. and I was getting mad because I can't even remember some of the things I was going to say.
But yeah, Duncan Jones, who did Moon and Source Code, two movies I liked a lot, and Warcraft, which most nobody in America saw, but everyone in China saw, except for Richard, he saw it, and he had a mixed review of it. He's doing a new movie, a new sci-fi film called Mute, which so far has cast Alexander Sarsgaard and Paul Rudd, and they've just announced that Justin Theroux, who stars in this week's Girl on the Train, is going to be playing the villain of the movie.
Yeah.
Opinions? Do we know much about what this movie is? Let me see if I can find a synopsis. There's some...
All I know is it's somehow like a air quotes... spiritual successor to Moon, which I get that. I mean, I don't know. I guess like kind of the way, you know, like Chappie was the spiritual successor to Elysium, which was District 9, Neil Blomkamp's like Junkyard Planet trilogy.
Right, right. I thought you were going to say Chappie was the spiritual successor to Short Circuit.
But that too. I mean, it was like... he found the robot from Short Circuit and, like, threw it away for years and unpacked it, and it was Chappie.
Right. Well, in this, they're calling it, they're describing it as the sci-fi Casablanca.
All right. So. I like Duncan Jones. Yeah. Moon was cool. Moon was really cool.
Mm-hmm. I like Source Code a great deal.
Yeah, it wasn't as cool as Moon.
No, it's like it's kind of like if Hitchcock had directed an episode of Quantum Leap.
Yeah, sure.
And I dug that, and it kind of went under the radar. Moon, to a certain extent as well, though I think that's a better known in sort of indie circles.
I like that Duncan Jones, kind of with Neil Blomkamp, is they're both making sci-fi like really relevant again, and exciting. Like the, you know, there's not many original concepts coming out of Hollywood, but seems that Duncan Jones and Neil Blomkamp can both kind of get them done, which is exciting.
Right. Some might say the same thing about Christopher Nolan as well, although his next film is actually going to be a war biop.
I mean, I think he's kind of... he's so big at this point.
That's a given?
Yeah, he can kind of do whatever he wants. Inception was... sci-fi-ish.
It's a sci-fi film.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but it's not as, like, hardcore nerd sci-fi. I don't know. We'll see. Okay. I'm excited for it.
And I'm also excited about Justin Theroux, who I think is a cool actor. Yeah. I've liked him ever since he was one of Brenda's boyfriends in 6 Feet Under.
Yeah.
And then especially after seeing him in Mulholland Drive, which I think was... a lot of people's first experience.
He's really good in The Leftovers, too.
Yeah, which is a hugely popular show that I don't watch.
Yeah, it's a third and final season's coming out in, like, January.
And
reheat those leftovers, folks.
okay.
That's the HBO, feel free to contact me if you want someone to come up with awesome taglines like that. Get ready to heat up those leftovers, folks.
Chloe Grace Moretz is set to star in a Suspiria remake with Dakota Johnson. Does that sound like a good idea?
No. Again, it's kind of that idea that nothing is sacred. Like, right. I don't know. I wanted to sort of talk about this story because you introduced me to the movie Suspiria.
A couple years ago, private screening in my house, yes.
Yeah.
The house that you also lived in.
I like how you like made movie night with your roommate and a few friends sound the most pretentious possible. Private screening in the theater room that I call the living room on the digital projection of our TV.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think this movie's going to kind of come out and no one's going to care because
right.
you're banking on this sort of cult movie's success for a remake. And we know that traditionally that goes super well in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's what blows my mind about this. They keep it's like literally the definition of insanity to do something over and over again and expect different results. They keep doing these remakes.
I think that's
and there's already a precedent with Chloe Grace Moretz starring in them because she was in the Carrie remake. She was in the Let Me In remake of Let the Right One In.
I mean, Carrie makes a little sense because that's
a bigger title. Everyone kind of knows
there were sequels. That seems like more of a bankable franchise.
It didn't do very well. Relaunch.
No, it didn't. And it didn't look very well. good. But yeah, I just like... Like, what is the purpose of remaking a movie like Suspiria? That's what I don't get is, you know, they're taking this sort of cult fringe movie and remaking it for a mass audience that isn't familiar with...
Well, they're banking on the idea that there's a known entity here. They're banking on the idea that it's an IP that people are somewhat familiar with. And that even if they haven't seen the original, they kind of know the name and the marketing will do itself. That's whenever any of these remakes come out, that's the idea.
And I think
they're totally miscalculating as they did with The Poltergeist, as they did with,
but again, to me, those movies are, I guess more sort of staples of like, you know, the horror collection is Poltergeist. Everybody has seen the original, or at least heard of it. Carrie, same thing. Everybody's heard of it. Suspiria, to me, that's a lot more like, I don't know, remaking...
Last House on the Left, because they did.
Yeah. it's a weird choice. I don't think it'll go well. My guess is it'll probably have a February release that no one cares about.
Exactly. And I think more so because, you know, these remakes get made whatever. They're going to keep remaking old horror films because they're probably cheap IPs to buy.
Sure.
And there's, you know, horror is kind of different than the other genres, like doing a Casablanca remake or something like that. Because you can make them for... dirt cheap.
And horror hounds will go to see
anything. They'll usually, depending on the time of the year, they'll usually make their money back because you don't have to spend a lot on them. Here's why I wouldn't do a Carrie remake with all of that. I wouldn't have done one of those either. But why I wouldn't do Suspiria. A Suspiria remake among even other horror films that have been remade. It is very much an auteur film.
Yeah.
It's very much... tied to its style, that Italian giallo horror of the 70s and Dario Argento's look and style and tone and movie.
Yeah.
That very surreal fairy tale.
I mean, isn't it called Dario Argento's Suspiria?
Yeah, I mean...
It wouldn't be a surprise if people say Dario Argento before they say the name of the
movie. I'm sure he'll end up being a producer or something like that, put a stamp of approval on it. But, you know, you could take that story of Suspiria about a girl being chased around by a killer or killers in a German dance studio. It doesn't matter what the story is. That's actually fairly like standard and boilerplate.
Yeah.
What matters is the style, everything about that. Same with Brian De Palma's Carrie, but is it's how it's made. It's not what the story is.
Yeah.
So if they're going to remake it and they're going to do, like, if it ends up being like one of those kind of platinum dunes, you know, blown out, overproduced, flatly lit, boring modern remakes with like CW teens in it.
I'm almost certain it will, because it's starring Chloe Grace Moretz and Dakota Johnson.
Right. Two people I'm not super into.
Chloe Grace Moretz, I think she has potential. You know, she's good in the Kick-Ass movies. I think there's something there, but I mean, Dakota Johnson, she's only been in the 50 Shades movie, right?
Well, now two of them. And
yeah.
And she's been in stuff. She was she had played a really small part in The Social Network.
Oh.
Yeah, tiny.
Well, I mean, she got into acting because her one of her parents is famous, right?
Yeah, Don Johnson is her father.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's just nepotism. I mean, I don't really care to talk about this, but I think Dakota Johnson could be better outside of the context of a 50 Shades of Grey franchise, as I think Kristen Stewart could be better outside of the context of Twilight.
Sure, and I think, Kristen Stewart has at least sort of, you know, something of a better track record. Mm-hmm. But man, I don't know if you saw 50 Shades.
Oh, I did.
But Dakota Johnson was real bad.
Yeah, the movie wasn't helping her, though.
No.
Okay. Well,
final
story. Disney star, where's his name? It just says Disney star.
Disney star.
Who starred in Teen Beach and R5, Ross Lynch, I think is his name.
Okay.
Is going to be starring in a movie adaptation of the graphic novel My Friend Dahmer, written by Durf. Is that his real name? Is he a hobbit?
He should really take a pen name.
Yeah.
Durf back Durfs.
My Friend Dahmer, which is a biographical
Durf back Durf sounds like the name of the dwarf with the red hair in Masters of the Universe.
Pingy Man.
Who plays that weird electric flute keyboard thing.
I think I maybe know what you're talking about.
That's a really bad impression.
Have you read My Friend Dahmer?
I haven't. I've heard good things.
Yeah. I mean, the basic idea of it, I think, is it's written from the perspective of a person who was friends with Jeffrey Dahmer as a teenager.
Yeah, before he was, like, the killer.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yes.
I think the graphic novel, I think it kind of jumps around in time, though. I could be totally wrong. But because I think it's kind of also about how he, deals with that. I think. Again, mm-hmm. I could be totally wrong. But yeah. So yeah, the story is Disney stars playing serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer
as a teen. And they got a picture, a side-by-side of young Jeffrey and young Ross Lynch, and they do look, you know, a lot alike.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know.
That shouldn't be the only quantity going into a casting decision, but, you know, it helps.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen Disney stars go dark before. Mm-hmm. You know, they grow up, they move out of the House of Mouse, and
Selena Gomez and Spring Breakers.
Justin Timberlake's Dick in a Box.
Well, I thought you were going to say Alpha Dog, but sure.
Yeah. We literally saw Kurt Russell spew out his own guts in, should I say? I don't know, spoilers? Spoilers. We literally saw Kurt Russell vomit out his own guts in Hateful Eight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's not uncommon for these, especially at this stage in their career where they reach the ceiling of whatever they can do in the Disney paradigm.
And yeah, and I mean, as
break through that.
An artist, you know, you want to evolve. I think it actually has to kind of suck, you know, for the first few years that you're trying to break out of that image, because it's, you know, the headline is Disney star is playing.
Yes, his name isn't even there.
Yeah, we had to really dig for it. And I think it's, I mean, one of the nice things about Disney is it is a launching off point for a lot of talent.
Yeah.
But one of the downsides is they kind of hang on to that image and that reputation for probably longer than is fair.
Yeah.
Like, I remember, you know, it. How long did I roll my eyes when I heard Zac Efron got cast in a thing? And, you know, to be fair, I don't know that I've ever watched anything with Zac Efron, so I don't know why I ever made judgment of him. No, period.
At all? You never saw The Neighbors or any of that?
No, I haven't seen anything.
He's good.
Sure, I'm sure. That's what I mean. Like, I still kind of had this weird Disney stigma with
actually,
him.
Actually, he's pivoted probably the smartest. Instead of trying to go dark or go serious or go LaBeouf.
He goes bro?
He went bro, which he leaned into really easily. Yeah. And he's kind of gotten inducted into that whole comedy world now.
Yeah, that's true.
Because he just did that other movie this summer.
Yeah, the Wedding Dates.
The Wedding Dates one, yeah.
The Zac Efron hangs out with the dude from Workaholics and yeah. Aubrey Plaza.
Right, and Anna Kendrick. Yeah. Yeah. Which I didn't see, but looked kind of funny.
Yeah, I mean, I like Adam Devine.
Okay, so that's the movie news this week. And if you follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/JabberPodcast, you can see any of the other stories that we post and some of the ones we don't talk about. We're going to get into the movie reviews now, and I'm going to do a quickie on the Magnificent Seven remake, which I told you I watched like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, and I wasn't going to watch it because I watched the Netflix homework that you assigned. High Rise. Any Jabber and the Drone listeners want to go watch High Rise, and we can start a web forum of people who saw it before Cassidy. That'd be cool. But anyway, you did see the Magnificent Seven.
Yes, this is the latest remake of the Magnificent Seven, directed by Anton Fuqua, who also did Training Day and Bait and other action movies. But he's a guy.
Yeah.
He's a guy. And, you know, one of the things that I went into this movie, I was a little less precious about this, the idea of this movie being remade, because, you know, in fact, the original Magnificent Seven was a remake of Akira Kurosawa's samurai film.
No. It was a remake of A Bug's Life.
Right. Seven Samurai. A Bug's Life also took a lot from that source material as well as many, 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 many other movies. It's a kind of commonly used theme, this idea of a group of outlaws fighting for a town that can't protect themselves. And in this movie, the group of outlaws in question is starring Denzel Washington as the lead, Chris Pratt as his mouthy sidekick, Ethan Hawke as the world-weary war veteran who may or may not have, like, post-traumatic stress syndrome. Vincent D'Onofrio is a weird-ass, crazy motherfucker, like, bare-skin-wearing mountain man.
I think that's just Vincent D'Onofrio.
I don't think he knew he was in the movie, yeah. Actually. And Byung-Hun Lee, who's a really popular Korean...
I can't help but be offended by the way you pronounced that.
I've been just pronouncing it phonetically.
Okay.
Who's a really popular Korean actor. He was in The Good, the Bad, and the Weird. He's in a lot... I think he was in I Saw the Devil and a lot of those, like, Korean New Wave movies. As well as other people.
Was that The Seven?
No, there are others, but they're less famous.
But there's seven.
Yes.
I think you named, five of them? Six of them?
Matt Bomer is in there for a second. Peter Sarsgaard plays the bad guy, and he's actually pretty good at doing that. I like the movie for what it was. It didn't reinvent the wheel. It didn't really challenge that form that I was talking about. It didn't really bring anything new to the table. It did exactly what I think it had to do at a bare minimum, which is let all of those charismatic actors be charismatic with each other on screen and, you know, pay off the action scenes, which it does. It's fairly standard, fairly traditional, but sometimes, you know, an old model works just fine. You don't need to reinvent the wheel with some of these kinds of concepts because why?
Yeah, I mean, you don't always need to go get a Prius if all you can afford is a Dodge Neon.
Well, I think they could afford plenty here. there's nothing wrong with the production budget. It is definitely high, and all those actors probably got paid, like, you know, five houses.
But hey, Dodge Neons made a lot of money in the day. I drove one.
Sure.
I don't know why I'm bringing this analogy to cars. I know nothing about cars.
Yeah, do you want to make this like a sports metaphor?
Yeah. It's me like further? If the football
did the scrimmage.
Yeah. And,
right.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I had fun with the movie. I didn't come out of it like blown away. I didn't come out of it thinking like, you know, this is going to bring back Westerns in a major way. They keep trying to make that happen. It never really quite takes. But I'd say if you want to go to a movie and not have to think too much about it, as far as empty calories kind of action filmmaking goes, this is pretty good. This is a dad movie. This All is right. a movie you would go see with your dad.
This is a movie for guys who like movies.
Yeah, this will be shown on Spike TV on repeat or USA. And
TNT, Labor Day weekends.
Yeah, it'll be very satisfying in that way.
All right. You know, I can get behind that.
Yeah.
I like watching movies like that with my dad.
Yeah. And you will like watching this with your dad. You can put that on the DVD cover.
Man, we are coming up with such good taglines tonight. Hear that, Magnificent Seven? Hear that, HBO? All Leftovers. Right. Heat them up this winter.
Now we're going to talk about Girl on the Train.
Oh, boy.
And
I've been waiting for this.
I'm going to let you set that up. What is going on in the plot of Tate Taylor's
Okay.
The Girl on the Train?
First of all, I just want to warn any potential viewers, this is it is a thriller. There are some plot twists. And I'm going to spoil the shit out of them.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. I'm going to get into it.
Okay. I try not to do that too much here on Jabber on the Drum. Here's what I'll do. We're going to review this
sure.
as spoiler-free as possible.
Okay.
And then we'll open up a spoiler zone.
Okay.
So people can fast forward if they want
to. I will do my best, but...
See, what is it going to say on the back of the DVD...
Okay.
For the plot.
Just,
what happens?
I'll just read it from IMDb. A divorcee becomes entangled in a missing persons investigation that promises to send shockwaves throughout her life.
Okay.
All right. I did a moderate warning of spoilers. I don't know. Let's get into it.
If it shows it in the first act or in the trailer, then it's not a spoiler.
Sure, but I mean, like, the trailer was pretty aloof in and of itself. Like,
right.
They were definitely marketing this to all the people who liked Gone Girl.
Yes, this is Gone Girl Light.
You know what? No. I was expecting Gone Girl Light. I was expecting Diet Gone Girl. What I got was RC Gone Girl. I did not care for this movie. Almost at all. I watched this movie alone in the movie theater today, and I very rarely... I don't know if I've actually seen a movie in the theater by myself before.
Like no other person?
Yeah, because it's usually a social thing. Yeah. You know, me and my wife go, or me and a friend, or whatever. It's sort of freeing, because there were moments when I almost audibly laughed out loud.
Okay.
Yeah, like you could probably hear my eyes rolling at certain points.
I'm excited.
I thought it was.
You're bringing fire. Okay.
So, I am.
I guess the basic setup for the movie is Emily Blunt plays this alcoholic lady who takes a train so she can go see her past life. She's kind of stalking her ex-husband, yeah. played by Justin Theroux, who we just talked about.
And my problem is everything... Every sort of character developing moment mm-hmm. gets unpacked like a plot twist.
Right.
And it's like from the beginning. Like at first you see Emily Blunt on the train. Then you see her with bottles of alcohol, which means she's an alcoholic. And mm-hmm. like let's... I like Emily Blunt.
Yeah, I do too.
I think she's a talented actress. I've liked her in most things I've seen her in. Later in the movie, she got better, but she was like cartoon drunk at the start.
Oh, you didn't buy Emily drunk?
She was Bobby Moynihan drunk uncle on SNL drunk. Like the very beginning, A woman sits next to her with her baby, and she's like, I want to see the baby. Can I see the bring that baby over here. It's like cartoonish drunk.
You were doing Bill Cosby.
Okay. My point is it's bad. It, like, their portrayal of drunk people is so cartoonish and over the top and right. just, like, and so, like, morality heavy. Like, alcohol is the cause of all the problems. Mm-hmm. And this is, like, in the first 10 minutes.
We're getting, yeah, this is just here's your protagonist. Here's your Clarice Starling.
Yeah, which, I mean, revealing she's an alcoholic as a character trait, sure, but it's
well, it's just both a character trait and a plot trait, because it ends up, I think what Tate Taylor, who, by the way, Tate Taylor is the same director who brought us The Help,
okay,
and Get On Up.
All right.
Get On Up is a little bit better. This is not his wheelhouse.
Sure. It was like, do you think you could do a David Fincher movie? And Tate was like, yeah, why not?
I'm cheap. I'll do it.
And I'm also going to say it's obvious this movie was directed by a man.
Right.
I was shocked to see that the writers were women, or at least one of them was a woman.
The writer of the source novel.
Yeah. But I mean, like, the screenplay. And
Krasinda Wilson, who adapted the screenplay, yeah. So, I imagine that that Hawkins, the writer, was probably pretty close to the project in some regard.
Sure. Which, but, I mean, it could just be, you know, that it's bad elevator, or not elevator. I'm going to pick up on this book for my ride up the elevator.
I'll just take it back and forth up and down. I think you were going to say airport novel.
Yeah, it could be. I'm not familiar with the source material, but I doubt this is the novel that shocked America.
Well, it did very well.
Sure.
And people are reading it. It's, you know, but it is airport fiction. So was Gone Girl.
Yeah, yeah. It just had, you know, a very stylized, talented director, a talented cast, mm-hmm. and a good screenplay.
I've actually heard a theory that I kind of believe, which is to say, like, and he can, you know, take this all the way back to Jaws or Silence of the Lambs, a lot of these things, that it's better to make a really good movie out of, like, cheap pulp than it is to make, like, a good movie out of, like, real literature.
All right.
Because often you have way too much to live up to. I mean, it's hard to adapt a book anyway. Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, airport fiction often has sexier hooks.
And it's all genre stock stuff. So you already have all that stuff and you know how exactly how to portray it. It's just about doing it well and bringing a lot of style to it. Which I think, you know, in the case of Gone Girl and Jaws and Silence of the Lambs, they do not so much here. But what I was going to say about Tate Taylor's direction of the movie, and kind of the way the screenplay, and I would imagine, I don't know, I've never read the book, but I bet the book tries to do this a little bit too. I think the movie has this, accumulative style with its plot. They don't, and with the story, they don't actually, like, let you know everything right away. It's in this kind of jumbled sort of non-linear way. And it's, I think it's supposed to mirror the fractured memory of the character, because her whole thing is she had all these blackout drunk moments and she happened to blackout on this big moment where a murder may or may have not have happened. And she is a suspect in this murder.
But the thing is, like, blackouts, like drunk ass, like that kind of drunk blackout, like your memory doesn't work that way. Like she sort of like gets sober and is like, I remember. And it's like that doesn't happen. Like,
no.
Like when you get blackout drunk like that, like that data's erased. You know, like, I mean, maybe through hypnotherapy or whatever, I'm not a neuroscientist, but the way the movie portrays it, at least, I did not buy it.
You know, like some of the plot mechanic stuff like that, like the idea that like in a flash or whatever, she'll remember a t-shirt or she'll remember like a fuzzy kind of image or something that she can. I get that. It's cheap and it's cheesy and it's pulpy, but I accept that stuff because we're talking about a genre that sort of runs on
my problem methods. Though was there was so much.
By the way, I didn't like this movie. It sounds like I'm defending it, but I didn't.
There was so much of that kind of stuff, though, that I felt like I wasn't left. I wasn't left with anything I liked. Is the problem? Is all I saw were these kind of tropey, pulpy methods, which didn't
detective movie stuff.
Yeah, which didn't ring true to me in the context that the movie set up. Mm-hmm. I didn't care for any of the characters. I thought most of them were flat. Man, we have three female characters.
Yeah.
Each one of them is just the most pathetic. Whoever wrote the screenplay, at least, or maybe it's the direction. I don't know. But had such a Madonna whore complex, it's not even funny. Like, no single character is well-defined on their own without the men, which are barely in the show, without the men totally defining them. Also, without being mothers. Like, even one character... Okay, this gets a little spoilery. This gets real spoilery.
Okay, go into it.
Even one character is revealed at the, like, one of the first things she says is, I don't want to be a mom. This area I'm living in is a baby factory. She uses that terminology and she's like, I don't want that for myself.
Right.
Then, here's the spoilers, we find out, A, she's already had a weird incest baby that she accidentally drowned, and B, she's pregnant again.
Right.
And she's going to keep it? Like, what the fuck? What the actual fuck? Emily Blunt's character is totally driven by the fact that she lost her husband to an affair and couldn't have a baby. Like, her whole trauma, her whole alcoholism, and that was one of the parts where you could hear my eyes rolling in the theater, was when we found out the cause of her alcoholism is the fact that she can't have a baby. Like, yeah, I get it. For some women, that would be traumatic. But that's not all women. And the only...
Hashtag not all women.
Hashtag not all women. Hashtag he for she. And then the only other character that we have is actually married and stole the husband from the other character and is currently... Yeah. I'm just like, really? You have three characters, not a single one of them is capable of independent thought outside of her marriage.
Again, I don't think the movie does any of that stuff very well, but I think there is an interesting note. Here's what I think. Again, this could be explicated better in the book than how it shows in the movie. But I think the movie is dealing with this idea of women's relationship to men as a theme. I think the theme of the movie is how women define themselves in the context of men. And I think the moral of the movie, or the ultimate story element of the movie, is this idea of absolution or actually finding yourself once you're able to divorce yourself from the idea of this fantasy of suburban bliss or
that,
whatever.
That could be a take on it. Like I said, I'm not blaming...
I don't think they do any of that very well, but I think that, you know, because it does give us all of these common, on purpose, I think it gives us these common roles that women play in society as mothers, as mistresses, as, you know, we have Allison Janney, who actually gives the only performance in the movie I really liked, as the bitchiest, most judgmental... detective in the
also,
history of film.
Also, there's some pretty fun stuff. I was pretty amused by their concept of the way the legal system works in this movie. because, Emily Blunt's character is at some point like a suspect in this murder, but like she never has to deal with what that actually means. She's never arrested. She's never charged. Like it's,
yeah,
it's pretty silly how they think suspects get around and
right.
get away with stuff.
And then she's able to actively seek out yeah. all the people in the lives of.
She frequently goes back to scenes that would be of interest in, you know,
in a murder case.
Yeah. In the real investigation. So, I mean, there was some stuff that was so bad, I was sort of having fun with it.
Yeah. And again, I think that stuff is like going for like a Hitchcocky obsession thing.
Yeah.
Again, not doing it very well. We should say also, Luke Evans plays the husband of the girl who goes missing.
Again, I'm kind of sad you didn't watch High Rise because Luke Evans is also in High Rise, and
right.
and there is some. I had sort of a weird abusive Luke Evans weekend, but I won't go too much into that because we might revisit it for another weird abusive Luke Evans weekend.
Yes, true. And Haley Bennett was also in Magnificent Seven.
Oh, well.
AKA not Jennifer Lawrence.
I mean, yeah, sure. Maybe the source material has what you're saying. But my problem is the film doesn't do that.
No, that's absolutely.
The film kind of contradicts that.
Maybe unintentionally, yes.
Yeah, like, I think 100% unintentionally. Well, I don't know. I can't say 100%. I don't know, Tate Taylor, whatever. But the way these characters are presented, the way we actually see them, mm-hmm. is pretty pathetic, I thought.
Well, yeah, I think the main problem is specifically, well, not maybe not the main problem, but one a huge problem is Emily Blunt's character, who is our Cypher, who is the, like I said, the Clarice Starling of this mystery adventure, is insanely passive.
Yeah.
She's a really boring character to follow, and she stumbles upon all of her evidence. She's never empowered. And the movie itself, and I think this is, for me, the biggest problem. It isn't the fact that it's unrealistic. It isn't because neither was Gone Girl. Like, let's be real.
No,
Gone Girl is fun as hell, and I think it's a great movie, and I think it basically does all the same stuff this movie does, but 1,000 times better.
Yeah.
But it is also pulpy and ridiculous, but and there's a lot of suspension.
The difference is, though, and I think it's, you know, I think it's mostly through directorial choices and acting choices.
Yes.
I'm drawn into the movie.
Right.
I reach that state of willful suspension of disbelief. Whereas in this movie, all of those things stood out like a beacon because the movie never does anything to actually draw me in.
Yes.
So instead, I'm so bored by a lot of the stuff that's supposed to be shocking and twisty that I'm pointing out the
little mistakes. Yeah.
Yeah. Or
the plot holes or whatever. Back to what I think the overarching problem is. I think the movie has interesting themes. There's a story there with Emily Blunt trying to, absolve herself from the murder. And at the same time, sort of,
absolve herself of her failed marriage.
Of her failed marriage.
Which and could have been interesting.
Yeah, there's a character arc there.
Yeah.
Within the story that could have worked. I think the biggest problem is it's just, if we're peeling away the onion here, it is basically a pulpy detective story, and it's not a very fun one.
Yeah, it's not very well. Yeah, exactly. There's no pulp to enjoy.
The stuff that it's the worst at is the genre stuff.
Yeah.
And that's where the movie, I think, needed to marry those ideas and marry those themes and marry the character stuff in there. Because, you know, David Fincher, he's making a big, you know, I guess to some people might look at as like a prestige film with something like Gone Girl or Seven,
mm-hmm.
or any of the movies, you know, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, any of the movie he's done. But he never forgets the genre stuff, and he always gives you the goods. And I think, you know, is oftentimes kind of giggling under his breath by how pulpy he's allowed to get in these movies.
And I mean, I think there were some attempts at that in this movie, but they, again, I think kind of packed onto the pretty unfeminist message. Like there's some pretty, you know, like titillating sex scenes and stuff.
Sure, it's trying to be like sexy and mystery. And,
but know. That's, again, sort of the problem. Aside from Luke Evans, Haley Bennett's character is she's presented as this sexual character, and you think there's gonna, you know, they're sort of gonna unpack something more interesting.
Yeah, she's sort of your icy Hitchcock blonde.
Yeah, but they never do. Like, she never really gets beyond Temptress, except with this ridiculous incest backstory, which they don't even really show how it affects the character.
No, it seems kind of incidental once. Everything seems incidental. Even when there's like bloodletting and some crazy violence, I still feel it just washes over me.
She like wakes up covered in blood at some point, and it's like, oh shit, I'm having a bad day. I got real drunk. Glub 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 glub.
I mean, this felt like a Lifetime movie writ large.
Yeah, totally. I actually thought a Lifetime movie, and that's where some of the laugh out loud moments came from. I will say the only thing I did sort of appreciate was, I mean, we're talking about objectification and how much Haley Bennett's character was objectified. I did appreciate how much they objectified Luke Evans' character. Or at least Emily Blunt objectified the character. And I sort of wish that that hadn't, like, that edifice sort of crumbles. Mm-hmm. And again, I think thematically they could have said something more there. But for like the first 15 minutes of the movie, I just called him Mr. Fuck. Because that's all you see him do is just fuck. And it's pretty ridiculous. Like, a train's passing by that passes by every night, and you're just gonna have like crazy kinky Cinemax sex, like right in the living room with all the blinds open.
Does she see into, because I thought that was like went from subjective to like omniscient camera during the sex scene.
No, she saw that.
We're supposed to believe that she can see all that.
Yeah, she saw it from like, she saw all, I mean, at least, yeah. It seemed like she saw it all from the train.
Okay, yeah, because we're supposed to believe that she, like, is, like, yearning for this perfect marriage that, that this couple has.
I mean, I guess you could make the argument that at some point it slips into fantasy, because there's a little bit of that, but not enough for me to think that's what's going on.
Well, I think, you know, going back to things, I think that is another problem with the movie, is if it's supposed to be this all-subjective thing from this character and this fractured narrative, because we were like piecing together the memories, blah blah blah, it should 100% commit to being entirely from her perspective.
Yes, and instead it's like sometimes from,
oh, they literally shift perspectives three times in the movies.
Yeah, but
all three female characters,
they do at first, like at the start they have like little title cards for each character, like a weird silly and really dour and so, like, you do shift perspectives, but then not.
But it doesn't commit
really
to that
much anymore after that.
Yeah, and then it just decides to kind of willy nilly cut like a normal movie.
Yeah, like you get the big reveal of what finally happens to Haley Bennett's character through her perspective, but again, that's kind of it. And then you literally don't get Rebecca Ferguson's character's. Like once for 5 minutes later on, after you sort of forget she's in the movie.
Right, right, right.
Which, okay, can we get full on spoilery now?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, we've been dancing around it.
I think you've already been there, but let's go ahead. If you really care about the last 15 minutes of the movie, then we can go spoiler zone for 5 minutes.
Okay, all right. So, I didn't think it was going to be Justin Theroux. I actually thought it was going to be Rebecca Ferguson's character.
Sure, I think that the movie wants you to think that.
Yeah,
she's sort of the obvious red herring.
It sets up a lot of red herrings.
Like, yeah, because for a while you're supposed to think it's Luke Evans because he's kind of abusive.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
Think that it's the therapist because of reasons.
But again, it doesn't even set up those red herrings well. Because, like, it diffuses the evidence very quickly. like before there's ever any real tension put on any suspect.
Mm-hmm.
But then the very end, okay, she's running. She's the super spoilers. If you're still hanging on, she stabs him in the neck with a corkscrew.
Yeah.
Which was silly. I mean, again, it was just, it was silly looking. And then Rebecca Ferguson comes and in this ultimate symbolic moment, twists the corkscrew deeper into him, and he's really dead after that.
Yeah, he's bleeding out by the neck.
Yeah, and then she's covered in blood. Like, she just learned that her husband is super abusive, which I don't know how he kept that secret, and that he's been having sex with everyone, but she just murdered him. Like, that's still her husband, and, like... Like, she's, like, maybe 75% sure he killed the other woman at this point.
Yeah.
But she doesn't know. She's just like, oh, yeah, you're definitely the killer. Not this woman who, kidnapped my baby. Like, I think she'd still be on the fence. So that, to me, was silly. I get that it was, like, this symbolic symbol of sisterhood or whatever.
Yeah.
And then the cops get them. They're covered in blood. They have the murder weapon, and then they just sort of believe him that he was the killer all along. Like, come on. That was so cartoonish
right. And
dumb. And there's no way. There's no way. Like, even if he was the killer, which there's still zero evidence that he killed Haley mm-hmm. Bennett, they murdered him. In what could have been cold blood. Like, there's... But they just go to... They go and... Because they both corroborate the story. Like, there's no investigation. It's just... At that point, I was like, okay. Really? Like, I thought she would stab him in the neck and mm-hmm. then, like, run in front of the train and get hit by the train. Because she was, like, sort of looking like it was going to go that way. Or that she was going to go to jail. Or, like, something of kind of a downer ending. I was wanting a better ending than just, like, they kill him and they're happy.
Yeah. I think when I walked out of the movie, my immediate thought was this is, like if First Wives Club had taken itself really, really seriously.
Yeah. Like, at that point, I expected them to be, like, sister wife mothers to the baby. And, like, it was just... It was bad. It was a dumb movie.
Yeah, I did not like it. I don't think I hated it as much as you did.
I just wanted it to be better.
I just thought it was mostly boring and that the direction specifically and to some degree the way that the screenplay was kind of pieced together could have been done in a more dramatically satisfying way.
I think it was really campy, and a viewing with a few good friends would lead to a fun night. So I would recommend it for that, because I think it is bad enough to make fun of.
You don't think it's too dour to be campy? I think it's too dour to be campy.
I think it could be really fun, like, in the right setting.
Yeah, good riff tracks or something.
Yeah, and the group of girls behind me who also hated it.
You said you were by yourself.
Yeah, but I heard them as they were coming out of the theater.
Oh, okay.
They equally hated it as much as me, and they were having a good time afterwards.
Do you think that primed you into it? To a hate fest.
No, I hated it way before I heard them.
Oh, okay.
Like, I was pretty committed to my not liking it, like, you know, a good two-thirds of the way into the movie. I was like, this isn't getting better.
All right. We're going to finish out now just by talking a little bit, instead of the Netflix homework, we're going to talk a little bit of what we're watching, and not into too deep of discussion, but what's happening on television right now? What are you watching? What should I be watching? What are you mad at me for not watching?
Yeah. It's kind of a weird fall season because a lot of shows have ended. Mm-hmm. A lot of networks are still trying out new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of new stuff coming out. Ashley and I are a couple episodes into Westworld. And it's really cool.
Yeah, I figured you'd want to talk about that. And I kind of gave you the floor specifically to talk about it because it's all a buzz on the internet.
Yeah.
Why is Westworld a television adaptation of an old Crichton project from the 70s? Why is it cool?
Well, I mean, it's Jurassic Park with cowboys.
Right.
And like kind of what you were saying with the Seven Samurai formula, like the formula just sort of works. And so I think that's part of it.
But how does it work as a television series? Because I can see that for a movie.
Yeah.
Is there just a really long buildup to the attack?
I'm curious. I think they're kind of taking the Lost approach to it. There's a lot of character development, a lot of sort of unpacking of themes and stuff. So I don't know. We'll see.
How many episodes are you in?
Two. I mean, it's only been on for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
But it is chock full of delicious visual style.
Mm-hmm.
Raymond Duarte. I'm offended by the way I said that name.
Duarte?
Yeah, the guy who did the theme song of both Game of Thrones and Pacific Rim.
Okay.
Also did the theme song for this. So it's got a really cool, like, intro graphic thing. It's just cool. I think it's ambitious for HBO. They're going full sci-fi, mm-hmm. which they haven't really done before. They've, you know, sort of opted for either period pieces or... Game of Thrones is the huge exception. You know, they went fantasy and it's paid off huge.
I'm sure that's why they're doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, from what I've heard, I think they are looking for the next Game of Thrones. I don't know that this will be the global sensation that Game of Thrones
is. Well, they don't have as much source material to work off of.
Yeah.
I guess they could expand it however they like.
I hope it's just not like a Carnival or Deadwood situation where they're like all of a sudden, this show's a little too expensive. It's just not worth it. We're pulling the plug.
Well, when Game of Thrones first started, I thought that's what that would be.
Yeah. Because
it was like everybody was talking about how cool it was, but it is huge production design.
Oh, yeah. And getting bigger by the season.
Well, but even just starting out and, you know, doing something where you need costume and period stuff, every single episode gets expensive.
There was like in the first season of Game of Thrones, I was like, there's no way some of the like fantasy elements are gonna pay off. There's no way.
Right. I thought that the whole idea of Game of Thrones would be is that it's too niche for a wide audience and that it's never going to find...
You were wrong.
I mean, I was completely wrong.
I don't know. Westworld. It's so far very cool, very stylish.
How's the performances? I know that Anthony Hopkins is in it, and he's been kind of hit or miss for a while.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of doing the he's playing John Hammond, basically. Right. And with appropriate Anthony Hopkins scene chewery.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
But it fits. You know, it fits the character. It fits the tone of the show they've established. Honestly, I think the thing is right now is, I don't know, there's still so much mystery that it's hard to sort of...
To know what it is yet.
Yeah. I mean, I'm two episodes in, but I'm happy.
People are liking it.
Yeah, like the episodes work on a lot of levels so far.
I want to check it out at the very least. An HBO show that I've been watching, kind of, sort of, I think there's been maybe three or so episodes. I've only watched the first official episode. The little, I don't know what you want to call it, like indie comedy thing, High Maintenance.
Okay.
The premise is it's based on this like series of shorts that they did like 2 years ago. They were like direct to Vimeo, 5 to 10 minute shorts. They did like 15 of them. Uh-huh. Back in like 2013 and 14.
Yeah.
And it's about this guy who is a weed delivery bike courier.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like about the shorts and what I think is going to reflect well on the series if they keep going this direction is he's not the main character so much as he's just the through line.
Yeah. Isn't his name just The Guy?
The Guy. Yeah. It's his character's official name. And what usually... The structure of the shorts where it would introduce you to whatever the shorts ended up being is usually more about the people he delivers to than him.
Okay.
And And sometimes you would just watch the entire thing and forget that that he would eventually show up.
Yeah.
And then at some point the story runs into him and you're like, oh, okay.
Interesting. So he's like the living embodiment of the briefcase from Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, he's more or less the MacGuffin of the show. And sometimes he plays a bigger role in the story. Sometimes he plays a very, very minimal one. And he's a good actor, and I like him. I don't have the thing up. I don't know his name. He looks exactly like a young John Malkovich, but with a beard. But he's a lot of fun. And a lot of the characters that they introduce, that they introduce in the shorts, that they're going to carry on into the series.
Yeah.
They're really fun. It's a lot of that kind of making fun of super entitled, industry-ish types. It takes place in New York rather than LA, but you could say that it has that same kind of like venomous, toxic, like 30-somethings that you see in like Girls or the show Love and that kind of stuff. And so some people might lose their patience with how awful everybody is in the show all the time, and some are less than others, but that does definitely seem to be a character archetype they're into, is just super self-obsessed, rich socialite type people. But I like the experimentation of the show. Sometimes it kind of reminds me of that sort of like experimental Woody Allen-esque thing that Louis does sometimes. It has that tone a lot of the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of TV shows can get away with sort of like this mini auteur movie thing because of Louis.
Right. The first half hour episode they did, I thought was really interesting and had some crazy gay sex scenes in it.
All right. I actually heard the creators talked about sort of the difference between the web series and the HBO series, and the creators like, well, now we can have sex scenes because like we didn't really feel cool like asking people who weren't getting paid to do like these sex scenes,
right?
But now
they're on HBO, so there's a quota.
Yeah, and now you know it's union, you know what I mean? Like it's industry standard kind of shoots, so it's they don't feel uncomfortable asking them to do this for a paycheck. You know, it's nothing that you're not going to be doing in like whatever indie movie or, you know what I mean? Like they're getting paid was the big difference.
Yeah. Are you watching Luke Cage? I'm not yet.
I think we're on the downhill slope.
So you're on like episode 5 or 6 or something.
Yeah. I think like 6 or 7, I think.
Is it cool? How does it hold up to the other Marvel Knights Netflix stuff?
It didn't catch me and hold me as immediately as like Daredevil or Jessica Jones. It's still really good. I like it. I love the there's a lot I love about it.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't totally click with me.
Mm-hmm. You're 6 episodes in. I don't know if it'll click for you at this point.
I don't know if it will click as much. Like, I still like it. And I think it's an important
show. Is it a plot thing? Is it a character thing? What's the issue so far?
Sometimes a little bit of both. There's a little bit of blaxploitation at play.
Sure.
And I think
they could have fun with that if they did it well.
I think sometimes that doesn't totally line up with the Marvel formula. Not that they're like not willing to go places or whatever. It's just, I think it could be a little campier on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not take itself quite so seriously.
Mm-hmm. Tribe Called Quest do the theme music?
Oh my God. The soundtrack is fucking killer.
Yeah, well, they're one of the greatest hip-hop groups of all time, so.
But some of the acting can be a little stilted. Some of the plot is a little like, what is it? What, like, why isn't Luke Cage just, like, go and beat this guy? You know what I mean?
Right.
So some of it just doesn't quite add up.
Okay.
But I think that the show is so asymbolically is working on fantastic levels. Like, there's so much symbolism in each episode. It's almost sometimes a little too heavy with the symbolism.
But heavy-handed or just literally too much?
Literally a little too much sometimes.
Okay.
But I also think it is really important that this show exists and sort of, like, it gets a little bit of a pass for some of the flaws, because, like, you literally have a black bulletproof hoodie-wearing hero in Harlem who gets shot at after, you know, and I'm not trying to get too, like, political on this, but I think that's an important hero to have right now.
Yeah, no, I could see that.
And so, to me, whatever flaws the show has, I'm willing to give it a little bit more, because they're definitely experimenting, too.
Mm-hmm.
It still fits the Marvel Knights formula. It's not, like, a total sore thumb. And like I said, sometimes there's a little dissonance there. But I think it's going to be an important show.
Okay, I just hope it remembers to be a good show.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't watched it yet, but, you know, you're pretty hard-pressed to... I mean, it doesn't sound like it by this episode, but you're usually a lot more of a lover than a hater, especially when it comes to properties you have some expectations for.
No, I mean, I
so I'm actually a little wary of the show now because of your indifference.
I have enjoyed it. It just, like, when Daredevil came out, it was like crack. It was like candy-coated crack.
But it was part of that kind of like, we have a new shiny bauble that we've never had before.
Yeah, part of it. You know, the second...
And now that we're in the third kind of iteration of this, it's kind of the same old thing.
Yeah. I mean, even the second season of Daredevil, I didn't think held up as well story-wise. The luster
worn off a little.
Yeah. And so I would just say Luke Cage is probably a little closer as far as that goes to Daredevil season two than Daredevil season one.
Right. First half of season two or second half? Because I think first half of season two should have been the whole season before all that bullshit with the ninjas, which I was that into.
I would kind of say just season two. Like there's a lot of good shining moments, and then there's a few like connectors that you're like, this doesn't quite add up.
Okay. I get it. Speaking of Netflix, the only other show I've released, I dabbled in. I haven't really seen enough to have like a fully formed opinion of, but Joe Swanberg just has a new series on there called Easy. And I guess it's about the sex lives of middle-aged suburbanites, who come from artsy backgrounds and are now feeling kind of like, saddled in their middle age.
I haven't even heard of this show. B, what the fuck? There's so many other shows that people are telling you to watch. And I mean, I can't say anything about this show because no one's ever heard of it.
I saw the tab on Netflix and I thought the graphic was interesting. And then I
still haven't watched Flaked. I think the graphic is interesting for it. As Will Arnett.
Then I saw that Joe Swanberg was a creator, and I have some vested interest in the stuff that he does. Joe Swanberg, in case nobody knows, was one of the, you know, the top original directors of the mumblecore movement in the mid-aughts. And he's released, a lot of movies to varying degrees of quality. But I really liked the last couple he did. I liked the Drinking Buddies quite a bit, and I thought that he'd actually reached kind of a new level of his thing. Also, now he's really kind of intertwined with the mumblecore movement. You can slap me right now for saying that, but like the whole, like, you know, he contributed a lot to like the Ty West movies and Adam Wingard and those, that kind of, cadre of, indie horror guys. So I'm interested kind of where his thing is, and to give him and, his own show, like they did with HBO did with Togetherness for the Duplass brothers. I was interested to see what he would do. First episode, it's a little bit of the stuff I don't like from him as much, which is whiny, 30-somethings, talking about, stuck
but,
in...
But, I mean, you also have to think, like, who are these people? They're probably now 40-somethings mm-hmm. who are sort of, like, writing about either their life experiences or people they know during their 30-somethings. Like, it sort of makes
sense. I understand why he made it. And it's in his wheelhouse, for sure. But, I mean, it's like... It was a half-hour episode, and I think it's trying, in some regards, it's trying to be a little bit more of a comedy than, okay. or this one episode. I believe, kind of like High Maintenance, each episode focuses on a different couple. But this first episode is about this kind of middle-aged couple, who are like early middle-aged couple, who are juggling kids and stuff. Their sex life isn't as hot as it used to be when they were young, and then they're all kind of neurotic about it. It takes place on Halloween, and they're trying to like get into role playing for the first time, and they feel silly doing it, blah blah blah. Right. And it's I felt like a lot of the concepts that was in the episode was kind of like this, I don't know,
just like
kind of sitcom-y and sort of like predictable, and they don't really do anything with those concepts we've never seen or heard before. And then it has, those kind of shockings, I guess, like Joe Swanberg-y moments of like realistic sex that kind of clangs against how jokey the rest of it was. And I think as far as that kind of mumblecore has done as a television thing goes, I thought the season one of Togetherness, which I have seen, was a whole of a lot. Better.
Yeah, I really liked Togetherness. That's coming back soon.
Is it? I thought it got canceled, didn't it?
No, it's coming back. It'll come back when Girls comes back.
I thought I read that it got canceled, but maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Okay.
Google it. Look it up for yourselves, listeners. Did Togetherness get canceled? The world may never know. I'm trying to think of other shows that... RuPaul's Drag Race All Stars 2 just finished. I don't know if you watched that, but as far as it's probably the best reality show on TV, massively entertaining. RuPaul just won his first Emmy for it.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. It's actually kind of a big deal because when he was nominated, he was like, this is. He was very public about how the fact that it was just a token nomination that he won't win. Mm-hmm. He appreciates that the Academy is at least getting better and actively trying to.
Well, it's like a logo show. It's like really deep into cable.
Yeah.
Like, but out of that entire channel, I think because
it's basically the RuPaul's Drag Race channel.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, Logo is just like shows like old episodes of Queer as Folk, and then. They show.
Yeah. As far as I know, they had like a.
RuPaul's Drag Race, which is really successful.
Yeah. I mean, they have like a couple. They have a few other original programming, but mm-hmm. not as. That have had the mainstream success as RuPaul's Drag Race, right. Which is surprising. I mean, it is a reality show about drag competition.
Right. I mean, it kind of takes that sort of America's Next Top Model / Project Runway format of, like, the competitions, and then they have to build things or show things or whatever.
But with the cattiness of flamboyant homosexual drag queens. It's,
which helps.
Super entertaining. And plus, a lot of the episodes have a good message.
Okay.
Inclusion.
I've never watched it actually, but
oh my god, should almost be a separate podcast. We were talking earlier about people who do TV shows
as a podcast idea.
Podcast, yeah.
I'm sure there are plenty of podcasts about RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yeah, but none that are like experiencing it from the beginning. You should untuck that.
Is that another one of your catchphrases?
You hear me, RuPaul? Well, I can't really...
World of Wonder, do you got this one?
I can't really take credit for that because they do like a behind-the-scenes thing called...
Untucked.
Yeah, okay, so I can't... Not like The Leftovers. Heat them up!
But what I do know about RuPaul's Drag Race... Everything I know about RuPaul's Drag Race is kind of like... peripherally, because I watched this web series. It's really dorky, this web series that's on YouTube called Hey Queen.
Okay.
And it's done out of L.A. somewhere. And it's done by World of Wonder, the same company that does RuPaul's Drag Race. So 99% of the guests are the drag queens from... And I also watch a World of Wonder show on YouTube called Transformations with James St. James.
How the hell do you not watch RuPaul's Drag Race?
He gets the drag queens from RuPaul's Drag Race to do drag ideas on him in these like 15-minute shorts.
How?
So everything I know about RuPaul's Drag Race is like from the periphery. And then every Wednesday I go pub quizzing over in Hamburger Mary's over Long Beach. And after the quiz every single night, they have a drag thing, and we have to leave because we all have jobs the next day. But they always say, it's starring so-and-so from RuPaul's Drag Race Season 7.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I mean, it pretty much makes the careers for a lot of these drag queens anymore.
And then their careers after, because they get the albums.
No, that's what I mean. Even
the makeup deals.
Even the ones who don't win are, you know... It's just like how comics used to come out of Last Comic Standing. You know, like it's
right,
the sheer power of being on TV still makes you a celebrity. It's sort of surprising. But you should go back and watch some of them. All Stars 2 was really good. There were some fun twists and turns.
All right. Well, that's going to be the episode. And if anybody has anything to say about any of the things we talked about here, the television shows, if you want to weigh in on that or the movie news, you can email us at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us and follow us at Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can follow us at jabberpodcast, all one word. You can find us and subscribe at our iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Our regular archives are at jabberandthedrone.podbean.com. You can also find us at Windows Podcast Network, as well as Pocket Cast and Player.fm. We're all over the internet. You can read my weekly reviews that I do for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also read some content I provided for the Seattle-based entertainment site MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Friend of the show, Brad Decker. He has his thing at panelandframe.com. Go check that out. And then be sure to listen to the other podcasts that are vaguely associated with us. Rod and Denise's Music Request Podcast, The Listening Party, and Patrick's Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. What do you want to promote? Because this is the time to do it.
You can watch my YouTube talk show. I'm a writer.
And the co-host of
Tonight in San Diego. You can go to www.tonightinsandiego.com. If you're in the San Diego area, you can get tickets on readertickets.com. We do live tapings on Monday nights. We're on hiatus for the moment. We'll come back in November. But it's really fun. We give away a lot of fun prizes. There is a Tonight in San Diego podcast as well, which I think we're trying to kind of retool up, so it comes out a little more frequently. I'll let you know more.
When you know more.
Yeah, when I know more. If you're in LA and want to see my Improv 101 graduation show, it's this Saturday. I don't even know if this podcast will be done.
It'll be done by Thursday, hopefully.
All right. So Saturday the 22nd at 1:15. In the afternoon.
UCB Hollywood.
Yeah, UCB on Sunset. It's just fun to say that I'll be doing a show there. And that's it for now.
Okay.
And follow me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid.
Yes. You have a Twitter. You believe in it.
Yeah, I tweet sometimes. I'm a twit-wit.
I tweet infrequently, but I guess you can follow me at BC Cassidy. Lately, I've been more doing retweeting than tweeting, but...
Yeah, that counts.
I guess. Okay, well, that's the show. Bye.